This week on Your Western Context, an economic report compares the energy industries of Alberta and Texas. The BC Speaker's chief of staff goes on an unnecessary summer adventure, and the ethics commissioner finds that an unapologetic Trudeau broke the ethics laws during the SNC scandal. This is Western Context, episode 131, recorded Saturday, August 17th, 2019. An interested public. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are back again this week, as we are each and every week. And, you know, it's summer, and we have a lot of news to discuss. This summer hasn't been quiet, has it?
It sure hasn't. There's been lots to talk about, and certainly there's been some big bombshell stories that have come out this week, both provincially and certainly the biggest one federally, which we will be talking about later in the show, of course. But it's definitely interesting to see the media's takes on each of these stories, and just showing all of the biases and all the sensationalism that they try and put in that we will always try and remove.
Yeah, and you know, that's the core aspect of why we do this show, and I think our listeners know that, and I hope the people who follow us on social media know that as well. And we've been doing this since the start of 2017, and our whole purpose of doing this is to look at the news, and with that, remove all the bias and sensationalism that you find in the mainstream media. And in doing so, we of course hope to provide you, the listener, with all the context and information needed to put yourself on the right side of the news. And we're going to start with an Alberta story this week, and this one's a bit of a interesting one because it wasn't talked about in the media, but it has huge ramifications for Alberta going forward for the next 10 years or so. And this is a report that came from the Fraser Institute this week. The media didn't really pick it up all that much. But the report's headline is that Lessons from the Lone Star State, Comparing the Economic Performance of Alberta and Texas. Now, of course, Texas is often compared to Alberta because they have a huge oil industry as well. And on this, Alberta often draws criticism for being too heavily focused on oil. But the situation isn't nearly as bad as it was in the 20th century and the 50s, 60s, and 70s, when the oil industry was being developed. Alberta has diversified since then in that the oil industry isn't as much of the portion of the economy as it was back then. But the question that comes up with this is it leads to further examination of how Alberta performs against other oil-producing jurisdictions in North America, specifically North Dakota being one of them, because North Dakota always comes to mind. There's, of course, Nebraska as well, and, of course, Texas. And these are just a few of them along the way that we're going to be mentioning. And the Fraser Institute came out with this report this week, and in this they compared Alberta's recovery with that of Texas going back to 2014. And keen listeners will note that 2014 is when the oil price downturn started and kicked Alberta into recession at the tail end of that year. Then, of course, following that, we had the 2015 election, and the NDP were brought into power, all in this storm of economic downturn that many see as was caused by the low prices of oil. But there's other reasons beyond that as to why Alberta didn't kick back as quickly as Texas did. Now, looking back to 2015, economists, political pundits, and the media have all said that Alberta's economic woes were due to this downturn in 2014 that precipitated itself through 2015, 2016, and we really didn't see progress start to be made until mid-2017 when the economy started growing, albeit marginally. Now, comparatively, we have to look at Texas because they dealt with similar price drops. But, as the report says, Texas did a much better job of creating an environment where workers can prosper. The study found that Alberta's unemployment rate was lower than the unemployment rate in Texas from 2004 to 2014. Of course, those are the years that many here in Alberta will remember as the oil boom under Premiers Klein for the first part, then Stelmach, then Redford. And, you know, looking at Texas since 2014, comparing it to Alberta, Texas has had a lower unemployment rate since Alberta, or rather since the recession started, and Alberta just hasn't been able to compete. Alberta's unemployment rate peaked at 7.2% in 2016, while Texas managed to stay below 5% from 2014 to 2018. Now, the report notes that there's many differences between the two jurisdictions, and I will personally note, and this is one thing that the report didn't say, that it's a lot harder to extract the raw bitumen from the oil sands than the mining operations that they do in Texas, which of course results in higher costs here in Alberta. But on the other hand, Alberta has run deficits caused by government spending, while Texas has run surpluses every year since 2014, except for one. And also, while this was happening, Alberta raised taxes and increased regulation under the former NDP government. You can also look at personal and corporate taxes. On the personal income tax-wise, the top rate in Alberta is 48% on every dollar earned over $150,000, whereas the top rate in Texas is 37%, and in Texas, it doesn't apply until you hit $300,000 in terms of income, and at today's exchange rates, that's about $397,000. And of course, we also have the corporate tax rates. We see that these are going to be ticking down, albeit slightly over the next few years, to the point in 2022 when they'll fall down to 8% here in Alberta. So that's, of course, designed to make Alberta as a jurisdiction more competitive. But when you combine this with all the new federal taxes in Alberta, the competitiveness of Alberta on the income tax front, when you compare it to other provinces, we recall that during the NDP's term, if you looked at the provincial income tax rates, we were about on par with other provinces. So there was no competitive edge there. But if you compare us to jurisdictions in the U.S. and even look at the corporate tax front, Alberta does not have a competitiveness edge. And by bringing in the UCP's business tax cuts that are going to be taking place until 2022, the thought, and it has been confirmed by economic theory, is that lowering these tax rates will cause Alberta to appear as more competitive and be more competitive on the international stage, thus drawing investment in. The report also cites increased regulations, the royalty review undertaken by the NDP, and the 100 megaton cap on oil sands emissions. The cap was something that the NDP government brought in with the carbon tax and their environmental policy. The cap was not addressed in the UCP's election platform, and as of May, the UCP has no plan to remove the cap in the near future. This is likely because the federal Liberal government has said that if the cap was removed, new in situ, and of course this means oil sands projects, would be subject to review under the new Bill C-69 that replaced the National Energy Board federally rather than as they are now through the Alberta Energy Regulator. In conclusion, there are similarities. The problem, of course, comes down to internal policies such as taxes, regulations, and barriers to building pipelines. And as we've said many times before on the podcast, a strong Alberta and a strong natural resources economy is good for all Canadians. And this has been something that's been harmed by the former Notley NDP and the Trudeau Liberals. So it comes down to voters this fall, where Canadians will have a choice to make whether about they want Canada to be a pro-energy development world power, or if they want to continue to lag behind. And that's a choice that will be made by voters this fall in October.
Yeah, it's interesting to note the similarities and the differences between what Texas is doing with their industry and what Alberta has been doing with their industry. Now, of course, as you mentioned, there's quite a few differences, namely population, ease of getting oil, and certainly diversity of economy. And the fact that Texas is located on a coast, whereas Alberta isn't, is also a major factor into actually getting their resource to market. But certainly, there can be lessons to be learned in how the approaches are made by the different industries and certainly by the governmental policies that have happened as well.
Yeah, and, you know, governmental policies, people often figure that, you know, this oil is mined in Alberta and we get it out of the ground and then we ship it away, so therefore it's primarily an Alberta jurisdiction. But as we've seen since the Trudeau administration took power, there have been changes made to the corporate tax front, to the income tax front and ultimately to the barriers and regulation of getting pipelines built, and that we don't have Northern Gateway, we don't have Energy East, and the only one we are going to have is Trans Mountain. So, of course, with that being said, there's lots of questions that Canadians need to ask, and this deserves to be an election issue come this fall. And most of the media, of course, is focused on affairs happening outside of Alberta, because when you look at it, Alberta isn't really competitive. If anything, there's only going to be one or two seats that are truly competitive in the province for anyone other than the Conservatives. And that means that in large part, the media is going to overlook Alberta this fall election. So it's the job of the Alberta media, the Alberta government, and us here at Western Context to bring these issues that Alberta has in this race to the forefront. And that's why this was one of our stories this week.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that Alberta isn't really that competitive when it comes to elections, for the most part, it means that certainly both of the major parties in Canada, both the Liberals and the Conservatives, do tend to ignore Alberta's interests when they're doing an election. And it's certainly the reason why you haven't seen quite as many visits to Alberta by Trudeau and Andrew Scheer in this pre-election campaign, since it hasn't actually been called yet, and certainly why they've been elsewhere, such as Quebec or in the East. They've been out to BC quite a few times, but they haven't really been seen very much on the prairies. And I don't think that's in a sense that they're ignoring them. It's just that they don't feel like it's quite as important as the rest of the country. And that's certainly going to rub Albertans the wrong way, and certainly a strong reason as to why Albertans want to make certain choices as to how they're feeling about remaining in Canada.
Indeed. And just before we move on to BC, I'll clarify what I meant by corporate tax increase, is that relatively the corporate tax burden in Canada has increased because the U.S. has lowered their corporate tax rate. So that's the distinction made there. But anyways, what do we got for BC this week?
So for BC this week, we've got a story that happened back on episode 95, and on that episode, I discussed the bombshell report that the BC Speaker of the Legislature, Darrell Plaikas, and his Chief of Staff, Alan Mullen, were investigating legislature expenditure irregularities. And if that doesn't make you excited, well, this one certainly will, because it's actually much more interesting than that. And expenditure irregularities were surrounding the Clerk of the House, Craig James, and Sergeant-at-Arms Gary Lenz. Now, James actually retired after he was found to have committed administrative misconduct, and Lenz is still currently on leave with pay and is actually the result, the subject of two ongoing investigations, including the RCMP. Now, the Speaker's report at the time provided numerous examples of alleged misspending on international trips. And now, fast forward to today, we're not even a year later, and Plaikas and Mullen are now under fire for their own alleged mismanagement of taxpayer money, which, you know, it was bound to raise a lot of questions. And questions are still lingering as to why exactly the Chief of Staff to the BC Speaker, Alan Mullen, spent more than $13,000 in taxpayer money to travel to 10 different provincial capitals and state legislatures. Now, Mullen went to government buildings in Alberta, Saskatchewan, Ontario, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, Montana, all the way back to Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. And he was doing that, going on this lengthy summer road trip, all to discuss security at those buildings. Now, the BC Liberals in opposition, mainly because Darrell Plaikas being kicked out of the party for becoming Speaker under the NDP minority government, which, of course, secured them enough seats with the Green Party support, they're mainly in opposition because of Plaikas, so they were understandably upset at the flagrant hypocrisy of this trip. BC Liberal MLA Jazz Johal said, quote, "We have spent $13,000 so Mr. Mullen could have his excellent summer adventure subsidized by taxpayers. These are routine issues that could have been dealt with within BC, and I don't know why Alan Mullen needed to travel across Canada and to seven U.S. states." Johal questioned whether the trip, of course, that he called Mullen's excellent summer adventure was even necessary, saying that Mullen could have easily gathered the same information by consulting in-house experts and experts in other jurisdictions without actually leaving Victoria. He said, quote, "I didn't know why the speaker's friend has to jump into a car and travel across Western Canada and the States to acquire information that is rather rudimentary." Now, Mullen has said he has no comment now, but he will comment once his report on the trip is released in September. The trip was originally budgeted to cost $10,000 and ended up around $13,000 instead. And the costs associated with the trip included mileage, hotels, and per diems, which are all standard costs associated with legislature travel. Now, because Mullen drove his own vehicle, the only expenses he incurred were for gas, hotels, and the per diems. Mullen explained that his decision to drive is a cost-saving technique. He said, quote, "Where we felt we could save money would be if I drove. We're not paying for plane tickets all over North America and rental cars." And he was asked, of course, why he needed to physically visit all these places. And Mullen said it was because you don't really get a full feeling for it if you get an email or if it's over the phone. You have a better opportunity to paint a picture when you've gone there yourself. You've taken pictures. I can communicate it better in my report. And he also added that the Americans were, quote, "thrilled to have us there and take part in their review." Now, spending watchdog Dermot Travis of Integrity BC says that he will withhold judgment on the merit of the trip until after seeing the report. However, he says that all trips of this nature should have budgets and travel plans publicly approved before they start. And he also said that there was a better way to go about planning the trip. He said, quote, "There needs to be some consideration in the Speaker's office that Mr. Mullen has rightly or wrongly become a bit of a lightning rod. The BC Government and Service Employees Union has an excellent travel policy. Why not adopt that for the BC legislature staff so everyone can see the budgeting and where the money can be saved?" Now, even though Mullen visited Alberta and Saskatchewan during the trip, he did not actually meet with either legislature's sergeant-at-arms, who would be the chief security official building. And officials in Ontario did not say who Mullen met with or what was discussed. However, the Americans were actually more forthcoming on this. In St. Paul, Minnesota, Mullen met with Chief Sergeant Bob Meyerson of the Minnesota State of Representatives. Meyerson would not go into any details of the trip, but described it as a nice meeting. He said, quote, "He wanted to know how we administer the sergeant-at-arms office here. We met for an hour, and then he toured the Capitol building." In Oregon, Mullen had a series of meetings that included a tour of the state capitol building, the general running of the Oregon legislature, security for members and staff, and how the speaker's office overlaps with the clerk's office were discussed. Now, the Oregon legislature's deputy chief clerk, Obie Rutledge, said that, quote, "He didn't indicate what the end goals were, and he said it was about fact-finding, and we wanted to share with him how we function." Now, all in all, it does sound like a fascinatingly interesting, excellent summer adventure. I know I certainly would love to travel to all the different provinces and states that he visited to tour their capitals, legislatures, and the like, and figure out what goes on in these particular legislatures. It sure sounds like a lot of fun. But, however, did our speaker's chief of staff really need to go on this trip when phone or Skype calls would have sufficed? Now, the costs themselves are not far off what a trip like that would take. It's whether the trip itself was actually necessary. Now, much of the BC media was quiet on this week as well. It got mentions in the National Post as well as in Global News, but no local outlets covered the story at all. And for Plakis, who has invited controversy into his office, it seems very hypocritical to undergo the same type of unnecessary spending that he just so recently accused others of.
You know, I think the only thing missing from this is a story of a potential bad hotel experience with his family. And, you know, I don't know if he took his family with him or even if he has a family and young children. But this sounds like exactly the kind of trip a young family would want to go on. And I'm not saying that this happened, but the way this is being framed by the media suggests that's the case. And you would want to know if that were the case. But why are these security concerns and examinations of the Alberta, Saskatchewan, Ontario, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, Montana, Oregon, and Washington legislatures all being undertaken. I don't remember there being any security concerns in the BC Victoria legislature.
Yeah, I mean, it's the security concerns all came down to whether the employees themselves were actually taking money, and that's all the security concerns there was. And once it was found out, they were escorted under escort by the police away from the legislature at the time. So really, I don't think there was anything wrong about security. And whether Alan Mullen, who was a former corrections officer, actually needed to go to these places to find out what they did with their security was, you know, also under question. And as to whether he went alone or if he went with someone else, he said that he brought an assistant along who incurred no further taxpayer cost. And when Plakis was asked whether anyone else accompanied Mullen on the trip, Plakis said that he didn't know and that it was irrelevant, as spouses invited on trips all the time. And that's pretty interesting in the fact that this could have, for all we know, it could have been Alan Mullen inviting his entire family on the trip. And the fact that he drove meant that this would have been a lot easier than if he had to pay for separate plane tickets for all of his different family members who came along. So as far as we know, it could have just been an excellent summer adventure with his family and going on a road trip that many of us would like to go on. But the problem is that it was done on the taxpayer dollar, and it was done with a flimsy excuse of visiting these different legislatures to find out their security practices, which is part of a concern that probably a lot of British Columbians don't think is actually a concern at all.
Yeah, you got to wonder why he didn't hit Manitoba when he was right below there in Minnesota and Wisconsin.
Yeah, and just the fact that we don't actually know if he even met with anyone in Alberta and Saskatchewan, just that he was driving through there. It raises a lot of questions, and certainly we'll be interested to see what the report will be on this.
Yeah, and we also have to ask about this. Why these states? And, you know, maybe there's something else going on with this. And it's also kind of unironically funny because, you know, as you mentioned, it is an NDP minority government, yet the speaker is not an NDPer. And this is just reflecting on what the state of the Liberal Party of BC was prior to them being moved to the opposition. And you're seeing that right here.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. We're going to move on to our big, big firing line this week. But before we do that, I'll just take a moment to remind everybody about our Patreon page, which you can find at patreon.com/westerncontext. And there you can support the podcast monetarily, if you so desire. And for $2 a month, the price of a cup of coffee, you can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, the price of a sandwich, you can continue to help us do that, but you can have your name read out on the podcast, if you so desire. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. When we reach $25 a month in contributions, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs are headed next. And at $50 a month, you can expect online town halls hosted every quarter. Topics of discussion will include the news of the month, the state of the media, and your questions. We also do have an option to make a one-time contribution via PayPal as well, which you can learn about at westerncontext.ca/support. And with that, we hope you'll check out your support page and enable us to do what we do here at Western Context, and that is remove all the bias and sensationalism that you find in the news and media. And, you know, we have that right now in this firing line. Of course, the firing line is our segment of the show in which we talk about a news story that was either completely missed or wasn't covered in the right way by the media. And this one is just so big that we really need to cover this from all angles to provide all the information and context needed. And this is the reemergence of the SNC-Lavalin scandal that gripped the country this spring. And the reason this is back in the news is because this week, Ethics Commissioner Mario Dion released his report, which found that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau violated the Conflict of Interest Act. And with this, we've gone from the allegation is false after the first report appeared in the Globe and Mail back in February to now this week, the Prime Minister saying, I take responsibility on this, but we'll dive into what exactly that means as we progress through this. So in particular from this report, the evidence showed that there were many ways in which Mr. Trudeau, either directly or through the actions of those under his direction, sought to influence the Attorney General. That's quoted directly from the report. Later on, Mario Dion said that the Prime Minister, directly and through his senior officials, used various means to exert influence over Ms. Wilson-Raybould. The authority of the Prime Minister and his office was used to circumvent, undermine, and ultimately attempt to discredit the decision of the Director of Public Prosecutions, as well as the authority of Ms. Wilson-Raybould as the Crown's chief law officer. And there we have it. Everything that was said in the initial Globe and Mail report, the testimony of Jody Wilson-Raybould, was indeed confirmed to be true in terms of the ethics investigation that the ethics commissioner undertook. Now, for those wondering about the conclusion from this report, what Dion found was that Trudeau violated Section 9 of the Conflict of Interest Act. Now, we need to underscore that this does not necessarily mean that Justin Trudeau violated the Criminal Code of Canada. This would be up to a policing body such as the RCMP to lay charges against Trudeau that would ultimately have him violating the Criminal Code of Canada for some form of obstruction, potentially. This does mean, however, that Trudeau, at the very least, acted unethically and broke the law in that he contravened the Conflict of Interest Act. It's as simple as that, and that's what the report says and confirmed this week. The Conflict of Interest Act is intentionally vague because it doesn't set out mandatory fines or punishments for those who break it, and the ethics commissioner is limited in terms of what he can do in terms of putting penalties on people who break the Conflict of Interest Act. Also with this, we saw cases this week where cabinet confidences weren't lifted, but we'll talk about that in just a minute. The ethics commissioner pointed out that Trudeau should not have put forward any arguments for or against the deferred prosecution agreement, and when he asked Jody Wilson-Raybould, he should have just asked her to have another look at the file, rather than saying that she needs to look at it in a specific way. And this was addressed in the report too, because while meeting on September 17th, 2018, in a meeting about SNC-Lavalin, Trudeau reminded Jody Wilson-Raybould that he was, quote, an MP in Quebec, the member for Papineau. The ethics commissioner then took this as an attempt by the Prime Minister to focus on the larger political repercussions in Quebec, both for the federal and provincial orders of government. Now, recall that when this story first broke, these were the words that we focused on here at Western Context as well, an MP from Quebec, the member for Papineau. Now, SNC-Lavalin is, of course, facing bribery and fraud charges related to alleged payments of close to $50 million to public officials in Libya between 2001 and 2011 to secure government contracts. And if they're found guilty, they could be prevented from bidding on and working on government contracts here in Canada in the future. Now, Justin Trudeau spoke to reporters in Niagara-on-the-Lake, Ontario this week when this report broke, and he said, quote, "We recognize the way that this happened shouldn't have happened. I take responsibility for the mistakes I made. Where I disagree with the commissioner is where he says that any contact with the Attorney General on this issue was improper." The Prime Minister also stated that he wouldn't apologize for protecting jobs. And here's his full quote on it. "My job as the Prime Minister is to stand up for Canadians and defend their interests. Yes, it is essential that we do that in a way that defends our institutions and upholds prosecutorial independence, but we need to talk about the impacts on Canadians right across the country of decisions being made. I can't apologize for standing up for Canadian jobs." And in particular, being interviewed by the ethics commissioner, he said he was concerned about SNC-Lavalin employees, shareholders, customers, and infrastructure projects such as the Champlain Bridge and light rail systems that are being built in part by SNC-Lavalin. And if you ask anybody in Alberta what they feel about this, they'll tell you that they feel that the Prime Minister isn't concerned about jobs in Alberta or in the energy industry in Canada. Now, Jody Wilson-Raybould herself also issued a statement this week that she posted to her Facebook page. In a nutshell, she views it as vindication, but also highlights the sadness she feels that this can happen in a country such as Canada. She wrote that the report represents a vindication of the independent role of the Attorney General and the Director of Public Prosecutions in criminal prosecutions and reinforces for Canadians how essential it is to our democracy to uphold the rule of law and prosecutorial independence. The report confirms critical facts consistent with what I shared with all Canadians and affirms the position I have taken from the outset. Though it wasn't all vindication, as she did highlight her sadness, saying, in a country as great as Canada, essential values and principles that are the foundation for our freedoms and systems of government should be actively upheld by all, especially those in positions of public trust. We should not struggle to do this, and we should not struggle to acknowledge when we have acted in ways that do not meet these standards. I am also concerned by the government's decision to deny even if its ethics commissioner requested access to cabinet confidences, as there were apparently constraints on a number of witnesses from telling the whole story. The commissioner is correct in saying that the decisions affected his work and should be made transparently and democratically, not by the very same public office holders who are subject to the regime he administers. Now, Jane Philpott, the MP who also stood up with Jody Wilson-Raybould in standing against the Prime Minister on this, also issued a statement saying that she took a stand based on principle because I believe my constituents want me to hold the highest ethical standard, and that she was saddened by the impact these events have had on our country. So for the Prime Minister, it comes down to I take responsibility, I was doing the right thing, but I'm not sorry. Now, recall that in 2015, the Prime Minister was elected on a platform of hashtag real change, saying he was different from former Liberal administrations that were brought down by scandal and corruption. But just like most politicians, they're elected by saying one thing and doing completely the opposite, in this case, to the detriment of the country. It'll be up to Canadians this October to decide the fate of Justin Trudeau, his government, and all the MPs that have remained silent on this matter.
Yeah, and I think that's pretty much a good sum up of what actually happened in this report and what happened with SNC-Lavalin, and certainly Justin Trudeau's attempt to subvert the rule of law in Canada is a big deal, and it should be made a big deal, and certainly was around made the rounds through the media, but it seems like almost not even a week later, they have certainly moved on from that, and just listening to Trudeau speak on this issue during the press conference, you have to almost translate what he's saying. And I'm not saying this because he spoke some French. I'm saying it's because the words that he was using were trying to, kind of circle around the issue. And he was trying to talk about it and saying the right things by saying that he took responsibility, but also by saying that he won't apologize for it, is almost circumventing what he said in 2015 when he was campaigning for election, in saying that when party leaders make mistakes, they need to fully apologize for them. And by saying that he takes responsibility by not apologizing, he's completely circumventing what he actually said himself just 4 years ago.
Yeah, and I think the people that I want to talk to the most on this, and I hope that this story is able to reach, is everybody who voted for Justin Trudeau in 2015 on the hopes that he would be different. Because, when you are being advertised something from a political leader, you hope it's going to be different, and you hope that there's going to be some benefit of real change and some good deeds that are going to come from that. But when you have a case where the justice system is in question, that's something that all Canadians need to look at. And that's why this is a two-part firing line, because firstly, we wanted to have a look here at what the Prime Minister said, what Jody Wilson-Raybould said, and ultimately what the report said, so that you guys have all the information to make these decisions come October. But also thinking about it, we need to think about what kind of government that we want. And that's why I hope that everybody who voted in 2015, whether you voted for Trudeau, though I would, as I said, I would like to talk to those people more, but everybody who voted in 2015 needs to have a look at this and realize where we are in Canada and what missteps almost all politicians are susceptible to making. And you said it best in that, you know, if you listen to what Trudeau said, he was saying words, but the words he said weren't exactly what he meant. They meant something else entirely.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that what he was saying did not mean anything, pretty much, is that is the case. You have to go by what he's been doing, not by what he's been saying, because often the two are completely different. And certainly this was picked up a couple times in the media, but this is where we go into our second part of the story, which is where I'm going to cover what the media and what certainly the reactions were to this story. And the report from the Ethics Commissioner, Mario Dion, that concluded that Justin Trudeau broke the ethics rules laid out in the Conflict of Interest Act, as we mentioned, was also the second time that he has done so since being elected Prime Minister in 2015, and it set off a bombshell in the Canadian media and the political landscape. And virtually no other story was talked about as widely or was as polarized as this one was this past week. And certainly the polarization in one respect is helpful to find out exactly where which writers and journalists and news organizations fall on the political spectrum just by how their articles were covering Trudeau's SNC scandal revelations, or which outlets feel that covering the story is more or less important. And we had a couple different sides of this issue. On the one hand, you have an outlet like the National Post, who's known for being more leaning to the right, center-right certainly. And their front page last night was dedicated entirely to Trudeau's mishaps from an NP View editorial with the headline, "Unacceptable Behavior from a Stubborn and Willful Man," along with opinion articles from Andrew Coyne, Rex Murphy, and Conrad Black, all of whom are of the opinion that Trudeau should not be reelected. Now, on the other hand, you have the CBC and the Toronto Star, who have already flipped the page. And if you go there to their website as of recording, you can't actually find anything on Trudeau or SNC or Jody Wilson-Raybould or the testimony or the ethics commissioner on either front page. And instead, coverage is dedicated to stories with strange headlines such as, quote, "Women on Country Radio are an endangered species," new research says. There's another one that says, quote, "She's a phenomenon, Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg sailing into stiff winds in the U.S., which has nothing to do with Canada whatsoever. And there's another one that came up, quote, "Royal Flush, Canada's best restroom contest pits an Alberta gas station against eateries in Toronto and Vancouver." And these were just some of the articles that came up on the CBC and the Toronto Star, which are known for leading more center-left or to the left. And these are outlets that have decided that the SNC scandal and the SNC story is something that Canadians clearly aren't interested in because they aren't covering it whatsoever. Whereas on the other side, you have the National Post, which says this is the only thing that Canadians are interested in. And I think time and time again, you have to ask yourself what biases each type of source is actually displaying. One of the sides is dedicated to self to slamming Trudeau at every opportunity, and the other side is completely ignoring the issue and swept it under the rug entirely. And I think these days it's becoming more and more difficult to find a measured source for controversial Canadian political topics. And that's why we're doing this story as a double header, because I don't think any outlet out there actually dove into the story and looked at all the angles and found out what people are actually talking about. Now, Shane talked about Trudeau's paradoxical response along with the statements from Jody Wilson-Raybould and Jane Philpott. But the interesting reactions didn't stop there. the Conservatives, who are clearly in full campaign mode, as are the Liberals, despite Trudeau not actually calling the official election date yet. Now, they were in full force on the issue. Scheer and Trudeau were actually both touring Atlanta, Canada right now, where a surprise result in 2015 saw all 32 seats from Newfoundland, PEI, Nova Scotia, and New Brunswick go to the Liberals. And likely that won't be the case in this fall's election. Now, Scheer and Trudeau both happened to be in Dieppe, New Brunswick, to celebrate National Acadian Day. Now, Scheer walked up to Trudeau at the during the parade and said to him, quote, "You have to stop lying to Canadians. You need to come clean." To which Trudeau responded very loudly, "Oh, this is a good day today." And then he walked away, and nothing more was said on the issue. Now, Conservative MP Pierre Poilievre was interviewed by CTV and was asked about what sort of provisions that could be put in place to make sure that this sort of scandal doesn't happen again. And he said that the only true measure to make sure that this doesn't happen again is to get a new prime minister. Now, there was more measured debate that was happening on TV and on radio, and interestingly enough, this came from Tom Mulcair, who is the former NDP leader and now political commentator with CTV and Maclean's. And he said that the statements that Trudeau made following the report's release, specifically that he simultaneously takes responsibility for the report and accepts it, while also not apologizing for it and disagreeing with it by saying what he did was in the public interest, is doublespeak that you see out of a banana republic. And he asked the question, quote, "How can the Prime Minister of Canada breaking the law be in the public interest? That's what doesn't work with saying with the press conference that we just heard. That sort of entitlement and arrogance saying that the law doesn't apply to me is unacceptable." Now, Mulcair also notes that the ethics commissioner was also refused critical information by the prime minister to even undergo his investigation, saying that what was asked for was, quote, "not important." And he made note that there was a similar obstructionist behavior that was seen in his actual SNC scandal. Now, Mario Dion, who was the ethics commissioner, also said that some of the witnesses cited cabinet confidentiality as limiting them from speaking fully about what actually happened. And while Dion had asked Trudeau to waive this, Trudeau directed the decision to the new clerk of the Privy Council, Ian Shugart, who denied the request for access. Dion slammed that refusal in his report, saying that although he was about able to gather enough evidence to come to a decision, he should have had access to all of the records in order to fully discharge his investigative duties. Now, it should be mentioned that Trudeau appointed Shugart after Michael Wernick, the former clerk, had resigned following outcry over what critics call inflammatory and partisan testimony regarding his own view on the scandal earlier this spring. Now, Brian Lilly of the Toronto Sun notes that now we know for sure that Trudeau's conduct with SNC was unethical. It's now up to the RCMP to determine if Trudeau is guilty of obstruction of justice. And the RCMP's National Division actually made a statement saying that it is examining the matter carefully with all available information and will take appropriate actions as required. And the RCMP didn't actually provide any additional comment. And Lilly also asks an important question. If it is okay to break the law to save jobs, as Trudeau said, how many jobs does it take to justify breaking the law? Now, Pierre Poilievre thinks that the job-saving angle is a lie, as he said. As SNC is primarily a construction company, the jobs that they would have been working on are located in Canada anyways, and that the job, if left by an SNC, would just be filled by another company, and someone would have been working on that job anyways. And he said, quote, "So there's no risk that all of those jobs would somehow vanish to another country when the work is actually happening right here in Canada." Now, Lilly also notes that if the PM can try to force a decision on prosecution, then what is to stop a future PM from calling a judge to get the decision that they want? And that right there is the dangerous level of erosion in the rule of law that clearly separates the legislative, executive, and judicial branches of power. And I think that's something that should worry people of all political stripes, no matter if you're liberal or if you're conservative or any other party. You have to be worried about what's going on with this. And for the Canadian media, just 2 months out of an election, covering up a national news story, especially one with this big of a deal, is unconscionable.
And we've just highlighted here the polarization that you see in the media on this, depending on where you go. And that's the whole point of this podcast, is to strip all of that away and remove all the hyperbole that comes from the political leaders, comes from the media opinion columnists and commentators, and get down to the core of the matter, which we have done, I feel, in this firing line. And it does come down to a question that, yes, the PM acted unethically. He broke the law. Remains to be seen if he will be charged under the criminal code for anything, if the RCMP will continue to investigate. If the RCMP do continue to investigate, this takes this whole story to another level, which at that point I would certainly hope that all the media organizations do choose to cover it in full, as they should if that was indeed happening. But the very fact that the RCMP said something when back in February they declined to comment, I think speaks volumes on this, that, yeah, there's probably something happening at the RCMP, and we'll just have to wait and see how long that takes to determine what they come up with on this. And there's a very real possibility that we'll be talking about this into September. And because of that, it's so important in this day and age, with the noise that's on social media, with the noise that's in the mainstream media, that there be a source that just strips all that bias and sensationalism away and provides the context. And that's why this was a doubleheader firing line for us.
Yeah, exactly. Just the fact that it was such a huge story, and the fact that there were so many different angles to it, and of course, just what Trudeau had said himself, and the fact that he was taking responsibility for the actions that he had undergone, but that he wasn't apologizing for it because he was standing up for jobs, just kind of buys into what the Liberals have been saying the past 4 years, and that they're standing up for Canadian jobs, and that they're trying to create more jobs, and they're standing up for the middle class. And when it comes down to it, the Liberals haven't really changed their tune over the last 4 years. They've kind of stuck on that straight and narrow. They've stuck on to what their platform has, and they haven't really wavered from that. Now, the decisions that they've made have definitely wavered, because, of course, they've made promises that they've broken, such as electoral reform, and certainly sticking to a balanced budget and balancing that budget by 2019, which has certainly fallen by the wayside. But the path that they've taken has not really changed in the last 4 years. So I think when it comes down to it, this will be an election issue. And this is coming up in 2 months, just under 2 months is going to be the election. And certainly the Liberals think that this is going to be forgotten. And certain Liberal media outlets like the CBC and the Toronto Star are willing to let the public forget about this by not covering it. And that is something that should be raising more questions about the Canadian media than are being asked right now. And I think that leads us nicely into our word of the week, which is public interest, which is defined as decisions made for the welfare or well-being of a society by balancing competing interests with full transparency. And this is something that Trudeau said. The reason why he took this decision and did the pressuring and broke the ethics law and certainly did all the things that he did on SNC was because it was in the public interest. And in doing so, he almost said that by breaking the law, he was doing it for the public's good behavior, and he was doing it on behalf of them, which is very interesting to get into as well, because it meant that he believes that he did this for the well-being of all of Canada, in the sense that he was standing up for jobs just with SNC-Lavalin. And in doing so, he was saying that by doing it in the public interest, that he was being fully transparent on the issue. But we already know that he wasn't transparent because of the cover-up of what he was trying to do with the Ethics Commissioner and trying to cover up certain documents that the Ethics Commissioner needed, and certainly by trying to cover it up by saying that the original allegation was false. to begin with, and then to only change his tune after it found out that it wasn't false. So that is why the public interest was our word of the week this week, because it just ties in so nicely to what was going on.
And, you know, I think framing it in the lens of the public interest is one that a leader could get away with if that leader had extraordinarily high personal approval ratings. And we're going to see what that looks like in the fall vote, whether Canadians are going along with what Trudeau says on this, or if they decide to punish him and his government for this with a defeat of some sort. So this is a very important story, and, you know, it, for many Canadians, I think, will form the election question. Was the SNC-Lavalin case in the public interest? And, you know, that's why it's a good word of the week, because it's something we're going to hear a lot about in the election period, and not many people know what it is. So that's why we're defining it here. So that is why we do word of the week. But if you want more information, such as all of the supplementals that we went over that cover all the various angles of the SNC story, or the story of the BC Speaker's summer adventure, or the report from the Fraser Institute, all of that and more can be found at westerncontext.ca in our full show notes. You can also subscribe to the podcast and any number of podcast listeners out there, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, Google Play, practically anything under the sun, you name it, at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context, where we share most of the stories that we're looking at and what we're up to throughout the entirety of the week. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always make sure to look through all the stories that the mainstream media talks about and some that they don't talk about, whether it's TV, radio, YouTube, print, you name it. We'll be there to make sure that we can cut through all that bias and sensationalism that we always see in the mainstream media, and to cut through all that to make sure that you have the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll see you next week for another episode of Western Context.